This is an interesting aside. Like, Henry VIII was never meant to be king. He was supposed to go into the clergy himself until...
Can you imagine Henry Tudor, Archbishop of Canterbury?
Soon enough, another day dawns. He gets up, gets out, attack the day, you'd say these days.
Did you just put Jake Humphreys in the middle of Wolf Hall, Matthew? Up at 5:30, eats a whole cod.
4 a.m, I've already read Tyndale twice. You guys are still in bed. Hello and welcome to Shark Liver Oil. I'm Matt.
I'm Dave, hello.
And we're back.
Yes!
After quite the hiatus. We do this every so often. We just sort of disappear for months at a time. Yeah, so we're back for our return. We've gone for something that's, I think, it's going to be quite challenging. So it's Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel. And, I mean, I think the reason it's going to be slightly more challenging than our normal fare is that because it's sort of a... like based on history, there's a whole sort of real world for us to get wrong as well beyond just the story. So we've got to get to grips with sort of the story, but also we'll have some kind of fairly like amateur forays into sort of Tudor history as well.
For those who are not in the UK, may not be aware that the state of English history education is basically, you do the Tudors 4 or 5 times before you're 12, and then at some point somebody decides it's time for you to learn about Hitler, and then you do nothing else until you leave school.
Yeah, that really was it for us, wasn't it? It was mostly
it really
Tudors.
Was just the Tudors, every day, which means that not only should we know a lot about this, but it's also been a minute since we did that reading, so almost certainly we're going to get it wrong. And the thing is that we are reading a book by Hilary Mantel, who was a genius, and didn't get it wrong.
I think the fact that she's done such a good job of sort of getting it right in terms of the sort of the history that she bases this book on is going to be a help, because we can lean on that, and we can also lean on sort of listeners. So if you do want to correct us on anything, do feel free to get in touch in the old school way that we use, which is email sharkliveroilpodcast@gmail.com is the way to get in touch with any thoughts on the book. As I said, we're going to do it in 6 parts, because rather helpfully Hilary Mantel's kind of done this for us. Normally I have to divide up the book, but it's kind of divided into 6 parts anyway, so we'll do that. So this week is part 1, and then we'll make our way through part by part over a luxurious 6 episodes, Dave.
It's going to be glorious. Can I ask though, did you choose this book because it fell into 6 relatively easy chunks, easy to work out?
There was elements of that in the decision making, but I'd say it was only sort of a small part. This is a book I read probably 10 years ago and really enjoyed, read a couple of times since. And yeah, and I think the fact that we both, thanks to our education, know a little bit about Tudor history, that gives us a start. And also the reason
not
this is
too much.
No, but also the reason this is one of the few sort of historical areas that they routinely teach at school is because it's so interesting. It's got, I mean, the story particularly of Henry VIII has got kind of, it's got it all, hasn't it, in terms of a drama.
So, what you've got is a central figure who was definitely crazy but was definitely also powerful for a very, very long time. And he was obsessed with having babies that he never really got to have. It's a really weird, like really, really weird mixture of like almost unspeakable power and total powerlessness, which of course is the thing we're going to get to.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing with Henry VIII is he's really almost more than any other king, one of real extremes. Like the things he's great at, he's incredible at, and the things his flaws are incredibly bad flaws. So he's sort of, I think that's what draws people, and obviously he's so impactful as well. What he did made a massive difference to English history.
Yeah.
And British history.
Yeah.
So, anything else you want to say like more broadly about the sort of the time period before we get in, or shall we just sort of roll on in?
I think I would say we learned it so much that we'll come to this more, I'm sure, but like we learned it so much at school that it kind of instinctively for me falls into a category when I first think of Tudor history is a bit of an eye roll, and it's a little bit like, oh, that's, yeah, with the black and white houses, brilliant. Shakespeare made jokes that you had to learn about why they were funny, right? And of course, that's a vast oversimplification. But that means that reading this book, I was really struck by how hard she works to make it feel immediate. And we'll get to that, obviously, in the way that she writes and that. But it was like, kind of just this period of history is so well visited, and yet I think this is a really interesting take on it. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it starts with a massive cast list. She gives a list of all these names. It's a good job she does, because I found, particularly the first time I read this, I was back and forth to this list of names time and time again to try and work out who was who. And this actually is one of the reasons I thought this would be quite good for the podcast, because I think if you do read through this for the first time, it's quite useful to have a bit of a guide with it, because not only are there a lot of characters, a lot of them have two names.
Yeah, very much. And I think, I don't know about you, but the highest barrier I faced to this whole book actually was the fact that there's a cast list at the beginning. Because you're like, right, here we go. Crack open the first page. Let's get me some plot and characters. Oh, hang on. Right, I will now try and memorize three pages of text in order to make sense of what's coming later. I always find this stuff really, really, really hard to engage with.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's indispensable, because you're dealing with, and this is actually a massive part of how this world works, is the different names and roles that people have change the way they act and change the way people respond to them. So somebody calling him Charles Brandon is thinking something different than somebody calling him Suffolk. Right, and like this, like, tangle of relationships, and so it's sort of an ice bath plunge, isn't it? Of like, kind of, this is like, pay attention. This is quite a socially complicated setting, and that turns out, Matthew, to be true.
Yeah, and just as you're sort of reeling from the massive three-page list of characters, you then get two pages with basically the very complicated English monarchical family tree.
So you've got, man,
Henry the Seventh, I mean, Henry the Eighth, all these. Yeah.
To be fair to her, what she's done there is set her stall out early and be very clear that this is the type of book that she is writing, and that she knows everybody had a hard time in history at school memorizing these family trees, right? Because I don't know about you, I always find family trees a really hard way of understanding the actual relationships between people.
Yeah.
Because you're in your own family, you've got, like, people who are older than you, people who are lots older than you, and people who are roughly the same age as you. And that you, like, you understand your place in those relationships. But, like, I always find family trees a really hard way of understanding the relationship of people to one another. But it was the whole substance of all of this drama is who married who, and whose brother was who, and who had kids with who, and how long did they last, and all that.
Yeah. And I think the two things with this is, one, this is what you often see in a history book, is sort of these family trees at the start of sort of each period. So it kind of sets its stall out as just how seriously she's going to take this as a historical novel. And also the fact you've got basically two parallel family trees, just to emphasize the fact that only a generation ago there was this massive power shift where the Tudors became the royal family.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, Richard, Duke of York, and sort of his descendants, which are sort of known broadly as the Poles. If you come across any Poles in the book, they've often got sort of royal blood and royal claim there as well, which adds to the
politics. And they're not from
politics.
Poland, we should also say.
And they're not
as far as we know.
It's true.
I would love that. I would love that if there was this whole kind of like deep linkage between English and Polish monarchies. And it had just been forgotten. I think that would be incredibly cool.
Mm. Then we've got a couple of quotes to sort of set us up. One of them being the sort of the names of the players in the drama. I mean, it's quite a nice way of setting this all out. I think what's clever about the intro here is you start with the family trees and the cast lists and the history, and then this sort of introductory page kind of sets up and this is what it's really all about, is the emotions and the flaws and virtues in everybody, every one of those names that you've just read. Yep,
that's it. I have nothing. See, you do it to me all the time. Just occasionally I have to clap it back and just be like, that's true, I have nothing to add.
So into part one, chapter one, Across the Narrow Sea, Putney, 1500. So this is this sort of, we meet Thomas Cromwell, who's going to be the sort of the guy we see the Tudor period through, or at least this sort of specific part of it. And at this point, he's a 17-year-old. Just before we get into him, I guess we need to sort of talk a bit about how much we do in terms of spoilers here, because it's a history. You kind of, if you know enough history, you know exactly what's going to happen here. I think we'll probably alight on the sort of main beats that kind of everybody or most people know. So basically, you know, this guy Henry VIII, he has six wives, kills a couple of them, marries the rest of them, a couple of them die, one of them survives. There's that.
It's an uplifting tale.
Yeah. And then Thomas Cromwell, I mean, he's not the most kind of, he's not the kind of guy that we would have done a lot about when we did our history classes, right? You hear about Henry VIII. If you go into a bit of detail, you'll hear quite a bit about Cardinal Wolsey and Thomas More. Thomas Cromwell's probably the next in line in terms of sort of how detailed you've got to get before you start really hearing his name. Because if you were to ask most people, certainly before Wolf Hall came out, who's Cromwell in history, you're thinking English Civil War, you know, Oliver Cromwell.
So, in a way,
this is her attempt to kind of both shine a light on this important historical figure and also kind of redeem him a bit. Because when you do learn about him outside of Wolf Hall, he's seen as this bit of a monster, really, isn't he?
Well, did you learn about Thomas Cromwell when you're doing the Tudors at many points? Because this is kind of my point about like the shallowness of the engagement with Tudor history, without wanting to diss too much what you get given at 11 years old in history. But like, I for sure didn't get this far. I got Henry VIII, six wives, little rhyme to remember him, a remarkably macabre way of getting to find. And maybe Thomas More, I think, as a senior clergy person at this time when the church is going through massive changes in England. I never heard of him. Had you heard of him?
Well, I mean, I kind of heard of Thomas More because I went to a Catholic school. He's kind of a big deal.
That'll do.
But also, I mean, and leading on from that, you know, Thomas Cromwell was probably one of his biggest enemies, which
you hear him as like the hissable baddie.
Yeah, sort of one of the enablers of Henry VIII as he breaks from Rome, I guess.
As he dismantles the church and fails to defend the faith, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, let's be honest, I didn't go into a great deal of detail at our school either, but I think kind of, yeah, there's a historical leaning against Thomas Cromwell.
Which, you know, you can understand if you're coming at it from a particular perspective. Thomas Cromwell, not the good guy. That's really fascinating, because he just wasn't a figure to me at all. And so there was actually a bit of me when I first started reading this where I was like, kind of, hang on, is this Oliver Cromwell? Is this what's this, like you? I'm like, the only Cromwell I know about is Oliver. But then you get this first chapter that presents him as like being exactly that obscure at the start of his life. Like he comes from nowhere that you'd ever write down. And that's what's fascinating, because the way we get taught history is the kings. And then having this figure who can let you sit very close to those kings whilst being largely unknown, it's just a really fascinating place to put the camera.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason he's either forgotten or sort of seen in a bad light in a lot of history is because he makes a lot of powerful enemies and a lot of his sort of friends sort of disappear by the sort of, this is about the rise and fall of this guy who comes from nothing. Yeah. But he makes enemies of the church, as I just said. He also makes a lot of enemies with the sort of upper class.
Yeah.
so that and eventually the crown as well. So there's not really anyone to sing his praises after that.
So here's a thought, right? I hadn't thought of this at all, but is there a little bit of the success of this novel being a kind of a 21st century kind of literary world which has, you know, largely thinks of religion as an irrelevance, if not a danger, you know, largely thinks of monarchy as an anachronism, largely thinks of aristocracy as a problem, like finding its earliest hero, almost, or like one of its early heroes. I'd never thought of it from that perspective before, but you think about the people that he squares up against across the course of his life. Actually, there's a way of writing him as a remarkably modern figure. Although I'm not sure that's necessarily going to be borne out, but I don't know what you think.
Yeah, it's definitely sort of the modern sort of perspective makes him sort of ripe for a like rehabilitation. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure that Hilary Mantel said about one of the reasons she wrote it was to do that, to sort of get behind the sort of stories around this guy and see what he was really like, and sort of peel back some of those like retellings where he's seen as a bit of a monster.
Yeah.
Speaking of monsters, I think his dad's a bit of a wrong.
Godzilla.
We start with his dad just giving him like basic, almost killing him with the kind of beating that he's given him. So it's a really sort of violent beginning, and kind of, I guess it's quite important to just get a sense of sort of this guy's beginnings and where he comes from, and sort of it gives you, I think you realise later on just how remarkable it is the way he is, even though he does always have this quite dangerous edge to him, but you can entirely see where that comes from considering how he grew up, because at this point I think he's later on it says he says that he's 15 and someone kind of doesn't believe him but kind of takes it, doesn't question him further to embarrass him, but you get the impression he's probably like 13, 14 at this point.
Yeah. It's a really powerful scene. It's a really horrible scene because it's a father beating his son, and what follows in the rest of the chapter is, while this is notable, like people are going to talk about the fact that Walter Cromwell is violent in this way, it's also not like shocking.
Yeah,
it's just like, oh, I'm saying, you know, some fathers nearly murder their sons on a regular basis. Okay, and then the actual way it's put, the first words in the novel are "so now get up," and there's a very obviously, you know, this is a story about the rise and rise of somebody from an extraordinary place, but actually the first kind of the only instruction he receives to get up is a mocking one from the person who knocked him down. So in one sense this is like big historical anachronism. On the other hand, I don't know if you have ever like sort of borne witness to this, but actually I think there is something quite English in a normalized background level of physical violence that's probably not going to kill you but is closer to the surface than we'd like to think. And I have definitely in the past seen somebody punch somebody, make them fall over, kick them, and then tell them to get back up on their feet. And just in the course of, you know, walking home from school or, you know, being in the wrong place for whatever. Like, and I think I don't know, they just felt like something very English about this scene, actually, as awful as it is. And what I kind of love is about the trajectory from this point of "so now get up," and you better believe he's going to get up. And there's just something, I appreciate that, and there's a kind of tight wound little dynamo that you kind of see being wound up in this moment, and doubtless the many moments that have taken place before this, which then spins this guy all the way from a blacksmith's yard next to the River Thames in Putney to looking Henry VIII in the eye and telling him that there's things he's not allowed to do. You know, there's just something really cool about that. The more I think about it,
yeah, he sort of passes out, and sort of when he comes to, he's kind of made it to the doorway of his sort of sister's place, which is this like inn stroke sort of it's kind of like sells pies and stuff, doesn't it? It's called the Pegasus, and his sister sort of sees him and sort of sets him down and starts to look after him. And we get a feeling, we get sort of a sense of like she's managed to basically get out and she's married someone, yeah. And she's sort of at least at arm's length from this guy, from her father now. And she sort of protects Thomas where she can. We also meet her husband, Morgan Williams, who's this sort of kind of a like semi-big deal merchant. I think he thinks he's a bit more of a big deal than he is, but he's got a bit of money, which is obviously
slightly
been
Boise from Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, he's kind of saved cutting that. He's got a bit of money behind him, and the fact that she can marry this guy gets her out of sort of Walter Cromwell's way.
But equally, much of the conversation they have is about how inescapable Walter Cromwell is. You know, he's going to get locked up, but he's going to get let out again. He terrifies people. He sells bad beer. Like he's the sort of person. He's a big man about town, and he's clearly violent and unstable. And it's again this really interesting thing about how the relative wealth and power of Morgan Williams, and they talk about the Williams family, and you know, like kind of they're sort of on the up and up, actually is easily counterbalanced in a completely different way by the fact that Walter Cromwell will just punch you as soon as look at you.
Mm.
And there's this really interesting balance between wealth, status and violence.
Mm.
And the fact that it has captured Tom and he has to try and escape it, but it's also captured his sister and brother-in-law as well to a certain extent. And it's just really fascinating little snapshot of, like, here's how this society works, just in the way Morgan Williams is dressed and is Catherine, isn't it? Cat Williams. The way she frets and is forthright and outspoken, but also accepts that nothing can change. And the way that Thomas actually has to do what he does next in order to get away from this mad situation, which is emigrate, basically, and disappear.
Yeah. I also find the power dynamic quite interesting with Kat and Morgan Williams, in that he's the one with the money who's effectively sort of, like I say, lifted her out of sort of a terrible situation and kind of saved her. But at the same time, you really get a sense that she's the sort of the far more, like, I don't know, she's the more powerful one in the relationship.
She's smart.
The way she speaks to him, she's not deferent to him. Like in many ways, he's deferent to her. And like she sort of laughs at his attempts to sort of do a little bit of like investigating around what happened. And he's boasting about sort of what he's going to do to Walter Cromwell. And everyone kind of knows that's entirely empty. I think towards the end, Thomas, like his memory, he's described as doing his nervous little Welsh punch, which is going, this is what I'll do to him, and just like,
I'll have him. Come on. It's a little bit scrappy do, isn't it? Yes, why are you order? Like, but again, like, I think there's something, so I agree with that. Although I didn't read Morgan as quite such a laughable character. I read this as the sort of marriage in which both people know perfectly well that they make up for each other's weak points.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And are very forthright about that. And I enjoyed that scene. But also I think where I agree with you on Morgan is that, like, he has to say that, right?
Yeah.
Like, he has to say, I wouldn't stand for that and I could have this bloke and all of that sort of thing. That's like, that's the trap of performative masculinity, right? In which the person who is actually willing to punch you until you die, even if you are his son, is going to win. And again, that I think is one of the things that puts Thomas, the young Tom Cromwell, on board a ship, is that, well, he can either be killed next time by his father, or he can try and find a place in his father's orbit, and neither of those are safe. Like, neither of those are going to be all right, because he doesn't have Morgan Williams' money.
Yeah, and yeah, they both obviously want to help as much as they can, but also, like you said, they're very aware of the sort of the constraints around them, and
yeah.
they start by saying, "Oh, you know, you can stay with us now, and you know, we'll find you a job here, you can do some accounting and all this," and then later on, Thomas hears Walter Cromwell sort of arrive at the house, and there's like a bit of a commotion. He tries to get in, there's banging and crashing. And then like the next thing, they're both saying, look, you're going to have to go. Yeah, you got to go.
Like we have written, I have done the very best I can with my little nervous Welsh punch.
Yeah.
And I'll level with you. It has not gone little nervous Welsh very far. So... I've got to do something about that.
Yeah.
And that thing is to send you out into the world. Good luck. Like, in a world with, like, no postal service, right? You don't communicate. If you're wealthy, like, you have these networks of relationships and you're either safe within them or, in Thomas's case, not.
Hmm.
And the only thing your family can do is, like, well, you're definitely going to die if you stay here. And if you stay here, we're going to die too. So probably, on you know... off you pop sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's sort of desperately sad. The other thing that I noticed about this, though, you mentioned that they say, you know, you can kind of have a job here, we'll get you doing some accounting and that sort of thing, was I think at this point, so they say that because he can read, right? Mm-hmm. And so, it mentions like, you know, somebody, so his mother or something, or maybe it was Kat, made sure that the priest taught him how to read. And I love that image of, given the relationship he has with the church later, of him getting this empowerment and this ability to be in a different situation off a priest. Because that was so much the dynamic, like at the political level, these arguments went and took place and continue to take place. But at the personal level, often it is a connection with, you know, with church or a school or a hospital or whatever that like enables people to be free of their circumstances in a way they otherwise wouldn't have been. And I really liked that image just as a passing idea, but it also made me think about sort of it's a miracle, like it just kind of there's no public education system, right? So like he happens to be able to do all the things that follow in this book and becoming like multilingual and incredible with numbers and politically powerful, the rest of it. He can kind of do because somebody was like, oh, he's under my feet. Go on, send it to the priest. Priest will teach him the letters. And that's it. And that's where he comes from.
Yeah.
This is like very ordinary character, but very extraordinary as well.
It also raises a question, which is answered later on, kind of, in that, like, how has he ended up... How's Walter sort of, like, allowed that to happen? You'd imagine Walter's not the kind of guy who's like, oh, get yourself an education, Tom.
Yeah, I'll support you in this.
Yeah. So we'll see more about that. Another thing about what he can do, you mentioned it just then. Just before he leaves, he thanks Morgan Williams in Welsh.
Yeah.
And they're all, like, taken aback that he can speak Welsh, and he kind of chuckles to himself. But this is really interesting for two things that are really important about his character going forward. And one is, as you say, how brilliant he is at picking things up and learning. But also how naturally he sort of guards that information about what he can and can't do. You see it time and again in the novel that often for very like politically astute reasons, but this is just to have a bit of fun with himself from what I can tell. He is careful with letting people know just what he can do.
Yeah, very much. I agree with all of that. And the thing I love in it as well is he cracks out a bit of Welsh. My family are Welsh way back. So I love that image of 600 years ago on the riverside in London, Welsh being a language that you speak because it wouldn't be now, right? But also, I really appreciate the image of a multilingual England.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, without wanting to get too heavy about it, there's a lot of people who would like to pretend that England is an English-speaking place and only an English-speaking place, and that any change in that is inappropriate or wrong or harmful or whatever. And, like, you know, I'm English and I'm Welsh. And I just there was just a little bit of me that responded to that, really strongly responded, actually, stronger than I was expecting, to this image of 500-600 years ago. Somebody in London speaking a language other than English, and that just being part of what you do and how things worked and how things were, because that's how things have always worked. That's how things have always been. People who speak different languages meeting one another. And it was just this lovely little image before he skips off and learns bloody Flemish and Latin and French and Spanish and Italian and all the other languages that we see him speak in the course of this thing. He starts off being able to say thank you in a language that didn't have a written form for another 150 years after this.
Yeah. Interesting historical facts. I try and pepper these in every now and then.
Lovely old job. There you go. See, you did the you remember the stuff that we did in high school, and I think that's commendable.
Henry VIII was the king who passed the first law to unify Wales with England.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
A lot of Welsh suppression.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. That. So those laws. You've got me on a high horse that you didn't mean to put me on here. Those laws were on the books in England until the 60s, right? Yeah. Like, and it wasn't until the 90s that you had, you know, the offer of universal Welsh language primary education. So, like, that decision has a big footprint. You know, the mad thing about it is, though, that is that Henry VIII was Welsh.
Yeah.
Tudor, Ap Tudur, that is a Welsh name. And you can go, there's a village on Anglesey, which is where the Tudor family are from. And, like... And it's this extraordinary thing because it definitely was a deliberate decision to suppress a sense of Welsh culture and Welsh language and Welsh identity, performed by one of the only three monarchs of England and Wales who was descended from a Welsh family. I don't really know what to make of that, but that is a really that's a strange kind of state of affairs.
Yeah. One other thing to say just before he's out the door, Tom, is that there's another reason beyond Walter's sort of the danger of Walter that Thomas Cromwell thinks is probably a good idea to leave. And it's the nature of sort of the reason he was getting a beating. It's basically what he came back after having a fight and Walter's beating him because of that, it seems. But his recollection of this fight...
How dare you act with reckless violence? I'll teach you.
But his recollection of this fight down by the river is there was a knife involved and someone got stabbed and it wasn't him. This kind of follows him through the rest of his life. But so it's important to sort of remember. But that's part of the reason he goes out on the road is he thinks sort of something went south there. And yeah. It's probably a good idea for him to kind of get out of town for a while.
And that's such a fascinating thing as well. Like the fact that it follows him all that way, again, in a country that doesn't have mass media and doesn't have, you know, communication, doesn't have letters, doesn't have anything that you would think would create strands along which stories like this would follow you about. Like if you go on living in Putney, yeah, either the guy whose brother you did it to is going to come and kill you. Or people are going to be like that Thomas Cromwell, you know, he's a stabby one, right? But he leaves, and it still follows him through his life. And it's this fascinating thing that he doesn't seem to be able to shake off, despite everything I would think of as how rumour gets around. You know, rumour presumably couldn't get around very far back then. But it still gets around with him.
Well, yeah, I think also it shows you the sort of ingenuity of some of his enemies that they're kind of like we need to get something on this guy. He came from nowhere. And they sort of ask around and try and find out sort of any dirt they can get on him. Yeah. He makes his way down to... He sort of basically says he wants to get to the continent and basically fight somewhere, become a soldier. He's kind of built for it. He's got the right sort of physical attributes to be a useful soldier. So he heads. He manages to make it to these docks. He sort of, again, you get this feeling of his ingenuity. He learns this sort of three-card trick that this guy's doing and sort of makes a bit of money from that. And then gets him
without getting killed. Like that seems like a great way of leaving somewhere because somebody's going to be really angry with you. And when you arrive in the next place, very rapidly choosing to learn something which is going to make a load of other people really angry with you.
And then he gets in with these merchants by basically helping them bribe the way onto this ship. Again, he's got kind of he's very canny. He kind of knows straight away kind of roughly how much it'll probably cost to bribe these guys. The lowlanders, which means they're kind of like sort of Belgian way, I think, like sort of Dutch, yeah. Belgian. I find that a little confusing at the start because I've known Lowlanders in the past to be sort of a Scottish thing because the Scottish. But then when they start talking a different language.
They've all got like quite soft Edinburgh accents that they can't communicate clearly with the English.
Well, then they started talking a different language. I was like, that's a bit strong. I'm not sure.
Since when did... That's amazing. Since when did people from Argyll and Bute speak Dutch? This is wholly inaccurate.
But anyway, yeah. In case you're wondering, these guys are Dutch, and they're really warm to him on this journey over. And by the time they get to, are they Dutch or Belgian? It doesn't really matter anyway. It's like that general area.
They're from the I want to say the Hague. No,
right. Okay, the Hague.
Yeah, no, I'm forgetting it. I think I'm wrong about that. But like, they definitely name the place that he's from because he keeps going back to it as well. Anyway, sorry.
Right, because it's one of these bits of the story I'm a little hazy in, so that's really helpful. So anyway, once they get there, they invite him to their house and say, "There's always sort of a place for you here if you ever want to come back." It's just, I think, like you said about the importance of community earlier on. I think for people like merchants, they often did things like this. They create little communities that you can jump between as you travel to different places. So this would be quite natural for them to do, to say, once they like someone, say, okay, you can always come and stay with us. Just felt a nice sort of act of kindness in what's already been presented as quite a dangerous and violent world.
Well, yeah, and I think there's something quite interesting in the... Maybe Hilary Mantel doesn't mean this to be drawn out of this encounter, but you've got to this point in the narrative, England is violence, and he gets saved by his Welsh-speaking brother-in-law, but not for very long. And the first person that shows him actual kindness, apart from his sister, is a foreigner from overseas. And there's an interesting thing there. But maybe that's overstating it. But I do feel like this like act of generosity is another really important bit of world building on the part, you know, you do somebody a favour, you show that you're useful to somebody, and their instinct isn't just to be like, "All right, nice one, mate, cheers, see you in a bit, buy you a pint," maybe, is to say, you know, again, in a world where connections are the people you know and that's it, "If you're ever here again, we'll look after you. You know what I mean? You can rely on us." And to mean it, I think, is a really lovely, like, really lovely sort of image.
Yeah. That's where we kind of leave him. And then we get to chapter 2, Paternity, and we catapult right forward to 1527. So he's now in his sort of early 40s. So we've just jumped through almost two decades of his life. I really liked this because I got to admit, when I first read it and he was a child, I was thinking, I'm kind of interested
in... How long is
this
going
to
be?
Yeah, I'm interested in the politics of this. How long is it going to take to get to the point where he's sort of with Wolsey?
You thought you were going to have the celebrity autobiography problem.
Exactly.
The first two-thirds of the book is like, "And I remember the number 63 bus, which I took on Mondays, Wednesdays and Thursdays, but Fridays and Tuesdays, of course, it was the number 61B. And I remember the taste of the lemon kale I had, and I'm going to get 400 words out of that because I'm getting paid by the page." Right, like, and then all of a sudden, bosh, he's like a child, traitor, multilingual, warlord, aesthete, politics.
Yeah, I think it's just great that she's got that focus on this is what the book's about, because you could write an interesting few chapters around his sort of adventures on the continent. That'd be a great story, but it's not the story that this book is about. So it gets you into it relatively quickly. You get a bit of place setting, a bit of an introduction to where he's come from, and then you're into sort of the actual like key part of his life that we want to look at. Yeah. So he's on his way in to see Cardinal Wolsey, which we'll get a better introduction to in a minute. He passes this guy called Stephen Gardiner on the way in, and Gardiner's his sort of like chief rival. He's from sort of he's basically a king's bastard, he's a bit resentful of that, but also he's got sort of a status in the clergy because of it. And he's always needly, genuinely hates Cromwell, and he's always needling about his low birth. He says the lines Stephen sings always in one note is basically all he does. He's just having a go at him with his low birth.
It's so good, and like it's such a great example of like Cromwell's like sarcastic, like he's carrying around a sarcastic cudgel, and he only taps you with it. But it's definitely a cudgel. Do you know what I mean? Like, and this, I love Stephen Gardiner's first line, which is just late. Yeah. Just the idea of somebody that's even now relatively senior in the church, right? And this guy comes in, the first thing he can think of to say is that you're late.
he is wonderfully grumpy, isn't he, Gardiner? Seeing all every single time you see him, he's always like this, just fed up.
In the TV thing, we haven't talked about this, but the BBC did a very well acclaimed TV adaptation of this, and
Mark Gatiss, person that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Playing Cromwell, and but I think the person they got to play Gardiner was
no, that was Mark Gatiss, wasn't it?
That's Mark Gatiss. Sorry, Gatiss, Mark Gatiss, sorry. And it was. I forget that. I'm now blanking on the name of the other guy. But yeah, Mark Gatiss, just this kind of like sneery, superior, long nosed, kind of always almost audibly picking up something unpleasant in tongues, kind of thing that's just so perfect for Stephen Gardiner.
Yeah, it's interesting. As a slight aside, we won't spend long on that, but it was Mark Rylance, wasn't it,
Mark Rylance and Mark Gatiss. Yeah.
But I always find he was brilliant as Cromwell, but he wasn't sort of physically imposing enough for me to.
That's
believe
true.
It.
He was not a bruiser.
Yeah,
like you needed somebody who was like. Doing politics whilst looking like somebody that could absolutely take you to pieces.
Yeah, because you might, from how he's described and his portrait, if you look at it in the Holbein did an amazing portrait of him. He looks like a bouncer, basically.
Yeah,
Cromwell.
Yeah, imagine a bouncer that speaks eight languages and has views on the future of the church.
Yeah,
just like and can manage the exchequer. It's just this extraordinary figure.
And you often see in the people's sort of reactions to him and how they deal with him, like it's just so strange to see someone who looks like this in like administration. He's either you're a knight.
That's it. He's a civil servant who looks like a bouncer and not the kind of bouncer that's won every fight either, right? Like kind of just like sort of crisscross of scars and stuff.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Anyway, so we then meet, speaking of interesting people, Cardinal Wolsey. What is your first impression of him? I mean, it's hard to set aside sort of what you already know from history, but what do you make of Wolsey in his introduction?
Well, I will start by saying that the primary thing I think of when I think of Cardinal Wolsey is the joke in Blackadder that this is about the weakest practical joke since Cardinal Wolsey got his knob out and stood in the corridor pretending to be a door. Which is an amazing line, but because it's such an amazing line, it's so phonetically perfect, it's imprinted itself in my memory, and all I can hear is, whenever somebody says Wolsey, all I hear is Rowan Atkinson as Blackadder saying Wolsey. So I will once again establish the lowest possible common denominator of my engagement with the facts of this book. Oh, nonetheless, I find him quite funny. I quite like Wolsey, and I have to remind myself of, you know, just the sort of the infamy, really, of what he's doing. Is he really enjoying being breathtakingly wealthy off the back of claiming that God put him there, right? And you know, this you can understand why a figure like Wolsey would make a figure like Henry VIII in the future feel like he has to. He can't have this many princes in his country. He can't have this many people who are credible alternatives to his authority. But I think Wolsey's really funny. Like, so, you know, like one of the early things, like Cromwell walks in and the cardinal's like, bring him cherries. and then he sits down and goes, and the cardinal goes, what else would you like? And Cromwell just goes, oh, the sun to come out, and the cardinal's just like, so late, you tax my powers. Like, he's making, like, self-aware little kind of, like, not quite self-effacing, but also, like, the joke there is many people think I probably could make the sun come back up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know what I mean? Like, that's the gag. But he makes it funny and he makes it charming. What did you think of him?
Yeah, he's very charismatic and I just thought a very, very strong leader. He's got very strong leadership skills. He's sort of like, you can see it. She does a really good job, Hilary Mantel, of sort of explaining why he is the guy that is so powerful in the kingdom when you've got someone like Henry. And also Henry, certainly at this stage of his life, he's renowned for promoting based on merits. It's very meritocratic, a bit like his dad was. And unlike most of the other kings in history up to this point, he promotes based on ability. So it makes sense that the guy who's at the top of the sort of pyramid here, even though it's sort of in that parallel sense with the clergy, he's been brought into this sort of orbit and made so powerful as Lord Chancellor because he's very, very good at what he does. But there's also that clear flaw in that he loves the sort of finer things in life and he loves showing everybody just how wealthy he is. And for considering some of the particular flaws of the king, you can see why that would get him into trouble.
Yeah, like, and you would think you'd have the sort of political nous to avoid that, which, again, spoilers, Wolsey does not. But what I particularly like about that is that he's also, and well, I mean, this is kind of said as a slur, but I think it's true in the narrative that Wolsey himself is a butcher's son, right? Like, you know, so you have these kind of, you've got these two characters here who are, I mean, Cromwell is just a very well thought of, you know, senior official for a powerful person. But Wolsey's second only to the king and sometimes not even that in the country. And he as well has come from this kind of butcher's boy position. And that's even more impressive actually than the arc of Cromwell. And yet it's gonna, again, sorry, spoilers, it's gonna end badly.
Yeah, although the interesting thing with that is there's even a lot of levels between the two of them. At one point, Cromwell talks about how, you know, he thinks Wolsey looks down from the lofty position of butcher's son to sort of, he finds Cromwell fascinating, like, where did you come from? And like, sort of, how come, it's like he looks at him sometimes like he's a different species. And that's him being from a comparatively low born status compared to obviously the king. It's just amazing, the little insight into just how many different sort of stages and strata of society there are between the king and Cromwell.
I mean, that's England, isn't it?
That's England.
Like, that's a presentation of how the class system and how people's understanding of themselves is and their worth and their own significance and their own identity proceeds from what was normal to them.
Yeah.
Kind of growing up and how it was normal for them to think of themselves in relationship to everybody else. In a way, the king's got the easiest job because he's just like, well, they're all below me.
The other interest,
everybody else has got a complicated bunch of arithmetic to do.
I'm just the top dog. The other interesting
dash Henry VIII
top dog. The other interesting thing about Wolsey is that he's even though he's in this very lofty position, he's not really concerned with maintaining his position. He's still extremely ambitious. He basically wants to be Pope. Sort of beyond that, he wants to create these great legacies that will outlast him. So he's dissolving some monasteries with the sort of church's approval, which is the difference later on, to create some colleges. So one in Ipswich and one at Oxford. The Oxford one survives, doesn't it? Still Cardinal College.
It's called King's College because Henry VIII is like, nope.
Yeah.
Yoink.
So anyway, so this is what Cromwell's been out and about doing. He's been raising the money for these institutions by sort of closing down or amalgamating some monasteries up in Yorkshire.
I was going to say, Yorkshire catches some strays, doesn't it, in this?
Yeah, it does.
How was Yorkshire? Filthy. Weather, people, manners, morals. As a graduate of the University of York, I will not stand for this.
I also love the
weather's about sometimes all right.
You can see why Wolsey likes him as well, because he's witty as well. Like he says, "Oh, there's no fish, there's no lemons." And Wells is like, "What do they eat?" He's like, "Londoners, if they can get them." But yeah, so he's sort of made his way back down for a sort of fairly miserable trip up the north. And it gets you a feel of sort of how Wolsey sees his use. Is basically he's the sort of get things done kind of guy, Cromwell, isn't he? He basically, Wolsey has these lofty ideas and Cromwell sort of makes it happen, and Wolsey doesn't really want to know the details. Again, it's actually quite it's a very effective way of like leading, isn't it? You've got the vision and you get someone else to actually make it happen rather than you.
And not make you culpable for many of the acts of theft or violence or indeed the burning of Whitby, as is suggested here as a joke.
Yeah.
Not knowing about any of that. I tell you what this reminded me of more than anything else is Thomas Cromwell here reminds me of the sort of role that Malcolm Tucker is given by the Prime Minister in the thick of it. Yeah. It's just this like absolutely terrifying bruiser with way too much power for what he's like, just travelling around like, you know, violently doing the will of the person that he works for with absolute loyalty. But like obviously neither sweary nor Scottish. So it's like, imagine Malcolm Tucker with icy self-control. It's a terrifying image.
They get into a bit of king chat and we sort of move into the big sort of politics of the time. And so the bit of history that sort of like we really learn, which is basically Henry VIII's been married for like almost 20 years. But the problem he's got is he's not had a son. It's quite interesting that both Cromwell and Wolsey, a man of the cloth, have both got sons of their own. The king doesn't. And it's sort of, and this sort of small but absolutely crucial fact is sort of the whole reason a lot of the drama in these three books happens. Because the king can't get a son and he can't understand why, because he's so powerful.
Yeah, exactly. And that, like, that sense of being mocked by God, almost, because, they, you know, you can't think of anything else that would be in control of this apparent absolute chance. Mm. But, of course, you know, if you look for long and you try and get angry with God for long enough, you know, you're not going to get anything back from that. Whereas if you start blaming the Queen, you know, you're the king. You will, as it turns out, do whatever you can to get away with that fact. Yeah. And like it is this awful kind of maelstrom of violence that kind of proceeds from the fact that the king can't have a kid.
Yeah.
Can't have a son.
Yeah. And we also get an introduction into how Henry VIII tries to get what he wants when he's used to always getting what he wants, but within the constraints of like the few things that sort of constrain him. So basically when he wanted to marry Catherine of Aragon, she'd already been married to his elder brother who died. So he manages to sort of get papal dispensation to marry her by sort of getting his clever lawyer stroke clergy to find a bit of, I think it's, is it Leviticus that says, you know, it's Leviticus or Deuteronomy, which says it basically gives him an out to do it. And now he wants to divorce her. He's doing the same thing. He's like, oh, well, find me something in the Bible.
Find me another bit of the Bible that says that I can do it. Yeah. Well, and it's fascinating, isn't it? Like, and this is one of the themes of the whole book, right? Is the theme of power and its relationship to religion and to faith, which I think are two slightly different things in this novel and in real life, is just really fascinating. Because on the one hand, the whole thing is, I absolutely have to do what's justified by the Bible or by Christian tradition. And then the other thing is, but that book and that tradition is broad and wide enough that surely you can find me a way to actually do whatever the hell I like. Mm. And like that whole thing of like respect for right and wrong and the definition of right and wrong being whatever the most powerful person in the room wants it to be is critical and also a bit terrifying, because he just obviously, like, 'cause nobody can say no to the king.
Yeah. Although the interesting thing here is there's the power of the church at this time means the few people who can say no are sort of members of the clergy. for the
right,
most part.
Right, exactly. And yeah. But that's going to become a problem for Wolsey because he's one of the people who probably does have to say no.
Yeah.
And he doesn't and tries to make it happen and does not succeed. Can I just, on the topic of Wolsey being really funny, I really want to read a bit of his stuff because it's incredible. Picture to yourself, Tom. Imagine this. You are a man of some 35 years of age. You're in good health and of hearty appetite. You have your bowels opened every day. Your joints are supple. Your bones support you. And in addition, you are King of England. That's just flipping brilliant, just as an image of somebody that's got literally everything going for them.
Yeah.
And it's just a way of saying, why can I not make this man happy? He is, he will never be happy.
Yeah, yeah. And it's he's got a plan to sort of handle this because he doesn't want this divorce to happen, basically, because it creates all manner of problems for him. So the way he's you have to handle Henry carefully, and he feels like he can. There's a really interesting little passage from Cromwell's perspective, which is such a perfect observation of Wolsey, where he says, "Years ago, it used to be the king is doing this." Then it became, we will do this. And now Wolsey says, I will do this.
Yeah.
It's sort of, and that just sums up everything that is going to lead to his downfall.
Oh, so what's interesting to me about this is that, in the context of the narrative, that's an arc, and that's a really interesting arc. But what happened after this was 500 years of people acting as though all clerics did that. And that just seems to me an extraordinary footprint for one butcher's son to leave on history. Was there no other sort of norm anywhere in the sort of constitution or the way that things worked? Or was nobody around to be like, look, here's how you deal with cardinals who fancy acting like they're the king in a way other than disestablishing the church? It just seems to be like a really interesting... I'm saying interesting, but obviously the violence that followed largely in the wake of this was horrifying. And it proceeds from the fact that you appear to have one clergy person who has ceased to pay attention to who's in charge in the country.
Mm.
And the only solution to that was to set the place on fire, more or less. It's such a weird concatenation of circumstances where things move really quickly and then appear to get in a frozen conflict for the next 400 years.
Yeah. So it's interesting because basically Henry kind of devolves a lot of the decision-making to Wolsey and that has turned into Wolsey taking it all on and deciding that he is basically running things and he basically feels like he handles Henry. And this is sort of demonstrated in his plan to sort of keep him married, which is he's not going to advise him to stay married. That hasn't worked. He's not going to sort of question whether or not it's, what he's doing is justifiable. What he's going to do is go to him, get some sort of lawyers together and go to him and say, look, we've just looked into this and it turns out your marriage is a sham and you've made a mistake. And just that crucial you've made a mistake, he thinks, will send Henry off into this rage because he's never wrong and send him running back to Catherine just to prove everybody that he's not wrong.
Ooh, it's a big play.
Which is a bold move.
It's a big play.
But at the same time, Cromwell's but he's also aware that Wolsey's setting up a potential marriage to some princess in France just in case this doesn't work. He's always got a few plans on the go, which you have to be in that position, presumably. So there you go. We get a bit of history around Catherine of Aragon as well. She basically arrives in England as a teenager, sent to marry Arthur, who's the eldest son of Henry VII. This is an interesting aside. Henry VIII was never meant to be king. He was supposed to go into the clergy himself until...
Can you imagine Henry Tudor, Archbishop of Canterbury? There have been some spicy individuals holding that role in the course of the history, right? But I think Henry VIII... who is later painted by Hans Holbein 100% with big upward curved codpiece on show. That's his idea of the decorum of royalty, right? That's the level we're talking about. you imagine him trying to take confession. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Have you? Well, you should hear some of the stuff I've done. Like,
it's an interesting game to play, but you can do wonder, had that happened, does he have a tilt at the crown anyway? I kind of feel he does. I kind of feel some rebellion happens.
Yeah. And so that seems really funny to me, because in England we haven't had the thing where, or rather, we have a different combination where the, you know, since Elizabeth I, the monarch is the governor of the Church of England. But like in Central Europe, you had this thing where you did have like bishop princes and stuff, and members of the aristocracy who were like, seems like there's another power source over here with the pointy hat. I'll have the pointy hat, put it in the middle of the crown. I am now a bishop prince, and both of them are getting passed down to my son. I better have a son. And that happened in countless places. And as we know, of course, the political history of Central Europe is extremely stable as a result.
Yeah, well, of course. We can't wander into that, else we'll be here all day.
Sorry, carry on.
It's hard enough getting through the British monarchy at the time.
The Reformation in England, yes, fair enough.
So, Catherine, so we introduced a bit to sort of her history, Catherine of Aragon. When she arrives, she's this sort of famously like beautiful woman. And Henry VII decides he wants to go and sort of see if this is true, sort of before she gets to court. So he rides out to meet her, and her sort of like everybody around her saying, look, you can't see her until she arrives. This isn't sort of protocol. And Henry VII's like, yeah, all right, okay. And then he just like jumps off his horse and runs in to see her anyway, because he's the king. But he's kind of struck by how, like, you know, how amazing she is as well, apparently. And you kind of get this sense of when she comes to court, the guy who will become Henry VIII is all sort of just thunderstruck by her. And then suddenly his brother dies and she sort of becomes potentially available. And it sounds like, you know, from this, that they actually had a good marriage for a long time. And it's just the fact that this son hasn't come along that's really soured things. And you do wonder with that. I mean, it's impossible to know, but the sort of the person he becomes, Henry, how much that's to do with that, and how much of it would have happened anyway, regardless of the son.
And it's the dilemma of like monarchy and Hilary Mantel, where she was writing this whole trilogy, like wrote about this like a fair amount about, in a contemporary sense, the significance of royal wives and the extent to which there is this, just the system is set up to focus a lot of attention on their wombs and like to make that an item of discussion in the public, and just the fact that it's a really weird system. It's obviously we still have a monarchy, right? Like, so that's weird. That's a weird thing that's kind of still the case, is that people are kind of, to a degree, pruriently intrigued by the fertility of somebody they've never met, and that seems to have some kind of political or at least cultural significance. And it's really weird. It's just odd. And I think this book presents that fact really, really, really well. I personally have no objection to the existence of a monarchy, but there's no denying that there are some weird bits that come out of it. And one of them is this fact that it's possible for somebody to be driven completely crazy by the fact that they don't have sons. And this has happened more than once, right?
Yeah. There's this nice little beat as well, like insight into what Catherine's like and perhaps why she might not be easy to just sort of divorce and then just have disappear. When Henry was off fighting one of his wars on the continent, the Scots came down and rebelled, and they were defeated. This was the Flodden Field battle. She wanted to send like the Scottish king's head to Henry in France as like a present, like to show, look what we did. And she's sort of advised against it, so she makes do with sending his like blood splattered cloak instead. But there's certainly a sort of steel to Catherine as well, in a sense of MacArthur.
She's not to be messed with. She's definitely like a political operator in the way that queens were generally, back in the day. because this is the primary means of doing diplomacy, right, was to marry somebody to somebody else, and so the person doing the marrying had better be pretty sharp.
Yeah, yeah. So this conversation about sort of business and sort of the king ends. Cromwell heads home, but just before he does, Wolsey says he's got some gossip about the Duke of Norfolk, who's another very interesting character that we'll get to know more of later. And Norfolk thinks that a spirit has been conjured to sort of follow him round and haunt him on the cardinal's instructions. And obviously both Wolsey and Cromwell find this hilarious. But he says he sort of saved this bit for the end because he knows it would delight Cromwell. And he's like,
it'll make him laugh.
Yeah, he sort of sends him out with a laugh because he says, you know, you got to trust me to save the best wine till last. And yeah, it's just, yeah, yeah. Again, like, I think it goes back to what you said earlier about just how he's very funny and very likable, Wolsey. And he's very good at sort of getting people to love him. Like he sends Cromwell out on that real high after having a couple of quite difficult conversations with him. And it's very cleverly done.
Yeah, very much. I really like the way he puts it across as well. He goes like, if anyone mentions it to you, just deny it. Yeah. And it's just like, have fun with it, basically, is the thing. Deny it with a smile. Like, go, this man is insane. Go forth and fill your boots.
Yeah. And the sort of the letter that Cromwell sort of composes in his head later is basically the cardinal strenuously denies that he's done anything of the sort, but he reserves the right to do it in the future. And he lists some of the
cardinal can neither confirm nor deny the summoning forth of malevolent sprites, but I tell you what, he could if he wanted to.
And Cromwell like lists some of the apparitions that the cardinal definitely hasn't sent, but then says, but he could send in the future.
We would like to wholeheartedly deny the cardinal's involvement in the slightest in any of the following.
So on to the third chapter and the final chapter for today, which is we get a bit of a look at Cromwell's home life. So this is at Austin Friars, which is the place that Cromwell lives. And his wife, Lizzie, is still up. I love the way this starts is just a sort of collection of short exchanges between the two. But it's they're very short exchanges, but they're just in a rhythm together. It's not sort of... You could hear those conversations and feel like there's something up between them, but it's clearly this. It's just how they both are and why their relationship works so well.
It is a really lovely, really actually, this image. And like given what you know about where he started and the kind of you do, even though he is a bruiser, even though he's, you know, been incredibly dismissive of the good people of Yorkshire, nonetheless, you like him experiencing the milk of human kindness, basically, just like warmth, homeliness, you know, this stable relationship is genuinely lovely. And particularly the fact that she opens the dialogue by just going, forget where you lived. And he's been away for like months, right? And it's just like, it's not even like, oh, how wonderful to see you, or this is a bit tense, or she doesn't know what to say, or there was an unspoken frisson between them. None of that. It's like, forget your address then. It's great.
One of the other things, so we get a bit of a feel for what his life is like. He's got a dog called Bella, which is the dog there's a dog he thinks about, like wants to take away with him when he's a teenager, and that dog was called Bella as well. So there's a little callback there. He's obviously named his dog after the one.
No, Matt. No, you're missing the obvious thing. What? The clear undercurrent in this apparently straightforward...
You're going to say 23-year-old dog here.
No, Matthew. Immortal dog.
Immortal dog.
There's fan fiction to be written here, Matthew, about Bella the immortal dog, and I'm here for it.
does Bella move? Maybe, like...
Is Bella move? Bella the mummified dog, also an option.
Oh dear.
I really like in this scene the way he goes, she gives him the letter and the dog while she fetches the wine.
Yeah.
And he's reading a letter from his son.
Oh yeah.
And his comedy is amazing. He goes, he greets us as if there were only one of us. Bad Latin. And you just like, it's just this great moment of like, how quickly have we accelerated from like, so now get up and I accidentally stabbed this kid on Putney Waterfront and I've got to run away to save my own life. To, he's declined that verb incorrectly. Deary me.
Yeah. I also love the content of Gregory's letter.
Oh, it's so good.
It's have you got it in front of you? I might read it.
I've got it. Hang on a minute. So we're gonna have to cut this out, but it's really good. Yeah. Right. So listen, he hopes you are well. Hopes I am well. Hopes his lovely sisters Anne and little Grace are well. He himself is well. And now, no more for lack of time, your dutiful son Gregory Cromwell. Dear Mum and Dad, I hope you are well. I am fine. I hope my sisters are well. I am well. And no more time now. Bye.
I'm pretty sure later on in the book, he sends basically the same letter again and again. That's basically...
Yeah, he just basically copies it out again and again and again. And just like, first of all, that is such an accurate image of what certainly I was like at 14. If somebody had made me write a letter to my parents, I would have been like, I don't know. Yeah, it's all good. Yeah. Bye. But also, like, and this actually becomes a thing in the rest of the book as well, like, Gregory Cromwell just being this, like, slightly basic, nice, rich boy, like, and that almost being Thomas Cromwell's greatest achievement, that his children are not marked by, you know, the spectre of their grandfather's violence, or, you know, or any of the things that their father has done or might have threatened to do or is seen as a threat of doing or whatever. They're just kids. Just, you know, rich kids.
Mm.
And, yeah. And it's just this really interesting, again, this thing of, like, generational change, which is obviously really significant in a book where most of the relationships are shaped by aristocracy, which is nothing if not carefully managed generational change. That's what that is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the reaction to that is quite interesting in different sort of characters. Like, you can either be, as Cromwell clearly is, sort of delighted that you're quite happy, at least, that your son is sort of doesn't have the rough edges that you have, and like you sort of see it as a plus. In the same time, there are other examples of very sort of individuals similar to Cromwell who are sort of horrified when they see that their son is quite sort of academic leaning and a little like less tough than dad, you know. They just don't understand how that can be your son. It's the reaction says a lot about the sort of father, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much, and it's fascinating.
We get another look at the king and the sort of the gossip around court, but from sort of Liz's perspective in what she picks up, and it's all this talk in the town about this giant jewel that was ordered to give to some mistress, and talking about who it might be for, and basically between them they come to the conclusion of sort of it's basically the king buying it for this woman that he's infatuated with now, who isn't his wife. And Liz is sort of very clear, like, hardline response to this, which is basically every woman in England will be against him divorcing his wife, is really interesting.
Yeah.
This, because it's a perspective that you wouldn't read in history.
Absolutely.
Sort of is read into by Hilary Mantel.
Yeah, but it tracks, right?
Yeah.
And it also tracks that you can imagine households full of women saying exactly this at this time as well. So it's a really interesting image of that, and there's a whole... And actually, that's an interesting point. I sort of, like, I don't know, maybe people do, but, like, one of the things that struck me when I did history at university was how much focus there was on, like, you won't have been taught, quote, women's history. Like, you won't have been taught history from a perspective of anything other than what the king does and what the king was and what got written down about the king. And, like, the idea of these other perspectives existing in history, I think, is something that we actually still don't talk enough about, and it kind of makes the world very one-dimensional to only think about it in terms of kings and battles. And I know when I did history at university, I had properly go through a sort of handbrake turn, as I say, from doing the Tudors 5 times and Hitler 6 times, like, to come to actually thinking about what constitutes history and, like, how the stories are told. And there's actually a really interesting thing here about that, both the fact that you've got a woman's perspective on the story and the significance of this duel and the rest of it, but actually more generally about the fact that this, like, you get this sense of the king being, the way the king is spoken of kind of happens in these like onion layers out from the person, right?
Mm.
There's what the king does. There's what people see of what the king does. There's what people say about what they see about what the king does. There's the rumours that pass out from the king. And then all the way down the line, there's something like there's this magnificent stone that could surely only have been purchased by the king. And that's enough for everybody to be like, well, the king's got a missus, obviously. Dear, oh dear. Little bit of stuff. Little bit on the side, right? And like, and you think, oh, that's quite funny and that's quite tenuous and that's maybe a little bit laughable and surely dismissible, except then you realise that's where the history starts. Yeah. That's the stuff that gets written down and that's the source, right? And they're like, all this stuff that's like conventional wisdom or things that people know or like the image of these significant people. One of the reasons it's damaging only to talk about significant people is that if they're significant enough, they attract layer upon layer upon layer of misunderstanding and conjecture and storytelling, basically. Mm. And I just, this really, again, it's like two paragraphs, but it presents you with how history happens.
Yeah.
And I just, I, so good, such flipping good writing.
We get a little dive into a little bit of the religious history as well here as well, because it turns out that Cromwell is reading Tyndale,
yeah,
and basically he's reading an English translation of the Bible, which is obviously
a politically subversive act at the time,
massively, yeah. And it's interesting that he feels he can do it, considering his position. And he says about Wolsey that he's, you know, Wolsey will burn books but not sort of heretics. So yeah. so he I think he feels he's got the space to do that and still morally work for Wolsey, because it's, they feel very sort of conflicting things, don't they? Being a prominent position in the church and also sort of reading this book that sort of the very act sets you dead against the church.
Well, but that's interesting though, because it sets you dead against the church because it happens that Sir Thomas More is in charge at the time. But two important dynamics around this, and I think one of the things it's really important to like reclaim from this, the way we understand this period of history, because what it ended up in was the disestablishment of the Catholic Church in England and centuries of religious conflict and so on. But to start with, Martin Luther particularly thought he was being a faithful Catholic in putting the 95 Theses on the wall at Brandenburg. To say, I think we've got something wrong here, and I think that we can change. And what's interesting is that the Counter-Reformation is a complicated thing to talk about, but one of the things that it is to a certain extent the Pope going, actually a few of those were worth listening to. And of course nobody will ever say that, because that would be a huge loss of face on every side, and what have we done all this killing for on both sides, right? But the fact that you've got this, but you're right, it is a dramatic tension, and like I'm fine with it sitting there as like a driver of dramatic tension, that this person who's working for the most senior Catholic cleric in the land is also reading the Bible in English, which you're really not supposed to do. But actually it's also a presentation of how somebody like Cromwell could think, maybe this argument's going to have its day. You know, like there were pathways from here which looked like the outcome that actually happened was probably considered quite a remote possibility at this point. But the other thing I was thinking here was the fact that Cromwell's like, well, the cardinal burns books, not heretics, is such a rich man's thing to say. Books cost so much money then. And he's just like, well, it's like, he's kind of like saying, you know, I've got 6 top of the range BMWs. So if one of them gets torched, price I'm willing to pay, to be honest with you. It's a flex.
It's interesting that his wife is the opposite. He keeps trying to get her to read it, and she's not interested. She's like, no, that's not for me. And again, the fact that I love how complex the this is presented. How she presents it is as complex as it must have been, rather than just you're one or the other. And if you're one, then it follows that your relationships will follow a certain way as well. Like they've got this very successful marriage, where despite the fact that over religion, which is really important at the time, they both fundamentally disagree on the sort of a very key point, but it doesn't matter.
Well, on a very key live argument, and that's the key thing, isn't it? Like, and you know, this is how debate plays out. Is in any given historical moment, the things that people really worried about, or really anxious about, or really really dig in about, and define themselves by. They do matter. Those aren't false opposites. But the fact that they're opposites you absolutely have to pick a side around, I don't think follows at all from the fact of widely divergent opinions.
Hmm.
And except when they do, and the whole choice of when is that point is the essence of the kind of drama. But then actually the human instinct is, I honestly think the human instinct around these things is to get along.
Mm.
And you have to work quite hard, which people are very willing to do, to feel safe. Like there has to be a big carrot at the end of the stick for people to really put the effort into hating each other. But people do it all the fucking time. And in the meantime, you've got plenty of relationships like this one where the fact that they love each other is far more foundational and fundamental to the nature of their relationship than the question on which they disagree.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a really interesting point. And I don't think that dynamic has actually gone away. And I think that's still true. I think there are plenty of people who disagree very deeply on very important things who nonetheless love one another.
Mm.
And I don't think that's a cop-out, really.
There are two other things with this that I just want to mention before we move on. One is the fact that some of the books that have been printed recently, in the first page is the line "printed in Utopia," which is a little sort of dig at Thomas More, whose famous book Utopia.
That's
this sort of place.
That is absolutely a clapback, isn't it? Thomas More's written a book called Utopia, and somebody's printed a book which Thomas More violently opposes and said printed at Thomas More's house.
The other thing is, it's just worth pointing out. So the king at this point, because obviously later on the things change very significantly, but at the moment he has this title of Defender of the Faith because he wrote this sort of searing like attack on Martin Luther in response to sort of Luther's
well book, I mean so. Well, and also let's not mess around, the monarch of England and Scotland still has that title, which you have to say is quite the front to put on. Gets given it by the Pope, within decades disestablishes the church in England, and carries on calling himself Defender of the Faith. That is trolling in regal Latin.
Well, I guess he used it to legitimize what he was doing.
I'm here defending the faith, exactly, the no true Catholic fallacy, right, is what Henry VIII is perpetrating. No true Catholic would follow the Pope.
With the final part of this chapter is we get a little sort of window into how Thomas and Liz met, in that he came back from his various exploits on the continent and was sort of taken into service by Liz's father, who had this sort of business that had been doing well and had sort of was starting to struggle. And he basically turned the business around, and sort of through doing that impressed Liz's dad to the extent where he said, do you want to marry my daughter? And he brings her down when he decides to do this and says, Liz, what do you think of him? And he's like, you've not picked him for his looks. And then they sort of thrash out a marriage deal based on that. But it feels like, it doesn't feel like she was just given. She basically thrashed it out with him. And it was this almost business deal that started their relationship.
Yeah.
And it, a sort of a proper marriage has grown within that rather than anything sort of more romantic, if you like.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think that's, I find that quite beautiful, because I think that still happens. And obviously being dewy-eyed about people getting married when they don't feel anything is quite a hard thing to do. But actually, like, I do think healthy, extensive relationships are a matter as much of choice as they are of feeling driven to them. And like, I think there's something very beautiful in people making such a choice. So the fact, it kind of doesn't surprise me in this context that, okay, so it started off with he needs money and she needs a husband. Great. But they're very open with each other about that's what it is. And on that basis, on the basis of that honesty, actually they clearly do have really a very strong marriage, which has become a very sort of nurturing and safe place, both for them and for their children as well. And it's a weird thing to be romantic about, but I just find that quite romantic, actually. Like, I quite like that fact of choosing one another and then make it and that being something that you build something really beautiful around, I think is really great.
Yeah, I suppose it is romantic in that sense. It's just, it's not the sort of traditional
flowers idea. And chocolates and yeah, I was carried away lovers. By my heart yeah. and when I woke up I was married sort
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then sort of they get to bed, he doesn't really sleep much, but soon enough another day dawns, he gets up, gets out, back into it, attack the day, you'd say these days. win the day.
I did get you up, just you beautiful cast-
What's it?
Did you just put Jake Humphries in the middle of Wolf Hall, Matthew?
He's getting up to attack the day.
He's getting up to attack the day. What is it? What is it, like world-class basics? World-class basics, the Thomas Cromwell story.
He's hitting his macros for the day.
He's hitting his macros! Up at 5:30, eats a whole cod. 5:45... Down the docks doing his press ups.
4 a.m. I've already read Tyndale twice. You guys are still in bed.
That's amazing. 3:30. Write theses 96 through 120.
Anyway, he's up. Start of a new day, and I like this little sort of beat at the end. He looks up and the sun's come out, and he's like, "Oh, he did it after all. We'll see." And there you it's have so it, good. Part one.
There it is.
It's good, isn't it? I think we've got to enjoy this.
Yeah.
So it's a good book.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
As we said at the start, if you want to offer any feedback on the book or on some of the points we've made in the podcast, sort of agreeing or otherwise, particularly if there's any factual inconsistencies that you've come across, we're very grateful to hear them. You can get us at sharkliveroilpodcast@gmail.com. That's sharkliveroilpodcast@gmail.com. I always used to say we're also on Twitter. We are also on Twitter, but we never do anything on it.
It's really funny because I used to hear in the litany, isn't it, of like, well, there's Twitter and there's TikTok and there's YouTube and get us on social. Don't get us on socials. We're not there.
You get us on email.
Get us on email.
Keeping it old school.
It's fine. And that sounds like we have a problem with social media. No, what we have a problem with is disposable time.
Yeah. I'm thinking of setting up a PO box, just taking it right
back. Oh, do it, Matthew. Yeah, you can set us a carrier pigeon. just whisper in its ear, "I'm Dave, hello," and it'll find me.
Maybe set up a landline with a voice, with one of those old-fashioned reel-to-reel voicemails.
Reel-to-reel voicemails. No, surely it's semaphore. Look, if you put flags out at a particular angle, it'll reach us.
Anyway, we'll settle and stick with the email, sharkliveroilpodcast@gmail.com. And so, do get in touch on there. But until then, Dave, we will return soon. I'm not going to guarantee next week, but soon, to do part two, which it includes the as you said earlier on before we came in, the intriguingly titled An Occult History of Britain. So look forward to that.
Good stuff.
See you then.
Toodaloo. Marvellous.